Often we think we know so much in the scientific revolution that has occurred since the Enlightenment. As we gain knowledge and gain understanding, we often think that not only have we mapped out all the world and much of our solar system and universe, we also realize, and we have to, that there's still infinite amounts of knowledge to be discovered and understood. When it comes to the animal world, which is what these sections are about that we just read, it's amazing to think of what we're still learning each and every year. It's 2026, and we're still, on average, discovering 16,000 new species each year. Last year alone, that many were discovered, and that's about 44 new animal species every single day. Here's some discovered in 2025. A new marsupial from Peru, a new manta ray in the Atlantic Ocean, the bumpy snailfish, these are some with interesting names that I picked out that were discovered last year, DiCaprio's Himalayan snake, the deep sea ghost snake, the glass castle bristleworm, James Bond forest lizard, that's in Jamaica, and my favorite for the last year's 16,000 species, the Lord Sauron piranha from the Amazon River. To know what's going on in the biological or zoological world means that a person has a certain amount of wisdom, whether you have a degree in such things or you just keep up with them, study them, love to draw pictures of them, paint them. There's a certain amount of wisdom that is to be gained from looking at God's creation. Often we call this subject in school science, and we make our kids learn about science, and that's a good thing, but that's also the wisdom of God in a sense. Not the wisdom from direct revelation, but it's God's natural revelation. And we're to look at that, we're to say, God did that. That looks beautiful because God made it that way. That process of how that thing works, and as we discover and see how it works, maybe under a microscope or a telescope, we're to see, look at God's sovereignty, look at his majesty, look at his power. And not only did he make it, but he keeps it all running. He keeps it running. He gives it the power to keep on running. He makes sure everything stays in place. He holds all things together. In the ancient world, knowledge and understanding of the natural world was seen as having great wisdom, especially so in the ancient world. Solomon, the wisest man who ever lived other than Jesus Christ, this is what was said of him in 1 Kings chapter 4. Solomon was wiser than all men. And then it goes on to explain his wisdom. So it proves that he's wiser because he had written or spoken 3,000 proverbs and his songs were 1,005. So there's his wisdom on display, but it says more about how wise he is. And we don't typically think of this as wisdom today, but certainly it was in the old ancient days. And Solomon spoke of trees, from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. Not just that he put those in his songs and proverbs, but that he understood things about them that other people didn't, that he could explain them, that he could write about them in a way that taught people wisdom about the world that God had made. To be able to speak on such things shows how wise you truly are. So when it comes to Job, God has a few questions for Job. And they're going to deal with God's creation. As I said, we started this two sermons ago, this chapter 38. And God opens up this challenge to Job. And you'll see the challenge stated by Yahweh in verses 1 to 3 of chapter 38. Let's look back at that. The first time God has spoken in the whole book directly to Job, then Yahweh answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Who is this that darkens counsel? By words without knowledge." So Job darkens the counsel of people talking, and he's almost trying to darken the counsel of God in a sense because he's saying things without knowledge, without wisdom. "Now gird up your loins like a man, and I will ask you, and you make me know." God says, "I've got some questions for you. Job, you've said a lot of things. Your friends have tried to answer questions. They've done a horrible job. But I've got some questions for you, Job. Are you ready? You better gird up your loins. You better get ready for battle. You better speak like a man. This is God asking you questions." And so he begins to ask questions. The first set of questions we looked at in the last sermon, that was on physical science, questions about the physical world. So for young ones who study science, this is the physical science part. We looked at things like the creation of the land, the creation of the sea, and these should be coming up on the slide just in review here. We looked also at number three, the dawn. And God's just asking Job, did you do this? Do you keep these things running? Do you make the sun come up every morning? Fourthly, we saw the underworld, the deepest, darkest parts, the place of death even. Do you control that, Job? The light. How about light? Did you bring that into existence? Snow and hail, rain in the desert. Also, the origin of rain and ice. We've seen a lot of rain since I preached this sermon. We had two chapters on rain, 37 at the end of 37 with Elihu. And then we had much of it also in 38. And then we saw a lot of rain, didn't we? And thunderstorms. And I just thought, man, this is a reminder of God's majesty, God's power, God's sovereignty. Or was I? Number nine, the procession of constellations. Job, do you put those constellations out there and make them come up in the right season and make them go down, make them disappear and then come back up again? And then the control of thunderstorms. Wow. So many examples of that recently. Tonight, though, he now turns, God does, in a second set of questions. He's got more scientific questions for Job. If part one was about the physical science, part two is about life science. Questions about the animal world, specifically the wild animals. God's and his wise providence of the world is shown in this section how he created and cares for these 10 different wild species. The horse is an exception, but we'll look at that. 10 animals, 10 species, we might say, of animals, and he's combining them into 7 paragraphs. Sometimes they'll be together, so thus giving us 7 points throughout this section of Job. What's the purpose? We can't lose track of that because we're going to go deep into some of these animals. What's the purpose is to say, look, Job, you didn't make it and you don't even understand it. How can you tell me how to run the universe? Now, Job didn't so much come out and say that, but when we ask God, why are you bringing this upon my life? It doesn't seem fair, especially to Job, who didn't sin to bring this kind of suffering on his life. And everybody's telling him, including his friends, he must have sinned because that's the way it works. Job, come on. You sin, you get punished. You sin, you get punished. Everybody grows up, they sin, they get punished in their household. You grow up as an adult and do so many sins, you'll get thrown in jail and so on. But sometimes people go through suffering and they didn't sin. And that's Job's case. And so he'd like God to answer and explain why he's suffering when he didn't sin. How does that fit in the ancient worldview or in today's worldview? How does that fit in our view of who God is? And God says, it's kind of like Jesus would often say, you answer my questions first and then I'll give you an answer. God is saying, if you can even come close to answering one of my questions, Job, then maybe we'll talk about what it's like to be sovereign. And so God begins to ask him these questions, now turning to the zoological realm. And God's going to show how sovereign he is, how majestic, how his all-powerfulness or omnipotence is what runs everything and controls everything. Job did not and does not ordain what happens in the world. God does that. So let's look at these in 7 groups, roughly 7 paragraphs. There's a couple, like in the LSB, of paragraphs that aren't separated. They should be, and I'll tell you where those are. First of all, the lion and the raven. The lion and the raven. That's the last paragraph of chapter 38. We've got these two magnificent creatures that God has some questions to Job about. Can you hunt the prey for the lion or fulfill the appetite of young lions? This is the Asiatic lion, roughly related to the African lion, very large lion that was all over the Middle East in ancient times. Today, you only find these in parts of India. But a large lion, the kind of lion that David fought, the kind of lion that's in the Old Testament in multiple places. And so God is asking Job, look, do you provide for the lions? This is an interesting question because lions go out and hunt their food. Lions go out and kill their food. They're the ones who feed themselves in that sense. But God is saying here that he's the one who provides the food for them to hunt. He provides the food for them to hunt. Without that food, the lions are going to starve. there has to be some prey for the lions to go after. If there's no deer or antelope or whatever's in the area that lions would eat, then the lions will starve. The lions will wither away. But God makes sure that everything's in balance in nature where the lions live so that the lions can get enough food. And the young lions, what about them? Who's going to make sure that the lions don't die off? Who's going to make sure that the cubs get the food? God does that as well. Verse 40 says, when they crouch in their dens and lie in wait in their lair. They're just sitting back in their dens waiting, especially the young lions. First few weeks, they're just drinking their mother's milk. Then the lioness goes out. She makes a kill. And then she goes back. It's interesting. We know this now. She goes back to the den and walks her cubs that are now ready to eat meat out to where the animal has been killed. And they eat the meat. But over all of that is God, who makes sure that they have food. God takes care of them. They're his creatures. He feeds the lions. Go forward to Psalm 104. This comes up in other places in Scripture, especially the Psalm 104 in verse 21. You think lions, king of the jungle, they do everything themselves. But don't forget, God not only made them, but he sustains them. He takes care of them. And Psalm 104 speaks of this powerful beast. The young lions roar, verse 21. The young lions roar to go after their prey and to seek their food from God. It's their prey. They've got to go after it. They've got to do the work like we do to get fed. And yet, where does that prey come from? Where does the ability to kill that prey come from? It comes from God. He's done it all. He has created them. And he says, look, Job, do you do that? Are you there? Can you make them hunt? Can you give them the prey? How about the raven in verse 41? Who prepares for the raven its provision when its young cry for help to God and wander about without food? You take care of the raven who doesn't go out and hunt its food. The food dies on the side of the road around here, and then the raven shows up and eats it. God is sovereign over the whole cycle of life and death. When things die, these scavengers that God made, they come and clean things up. Aren't we thankful they do? Do you know how much roadkill would be on Texas roads? Just in my neighborhood alone. Deer dies. People are like, oh, we got to take care of this animal. Who do we call? They ask on Facebook group, who do we call to haul off an animal? And people say, just leave it there. The vultures will take care of it. And occasionally we see a raven around here as well. Normally it's turkey vultures driving up on the back roads to get to church. You'll see these. They clean up. God provides for them because there's a dead animal and they're his scavengers. They're his cleaners that he sends in. Again, Psalm 147 verse 9 speaks of this. Who gives to the animal its food and to the young ravens which call out? The young ravens call out. They need to be fed to grow. God provides for them. He gives them a dead animal to eat. He gives them meat. Thank God that we have these things, or things would be very smelly around here. Secondly, the mountain goat and the deer. So Job is not going to be able to answer these questions. He hasn't answered the ones already asked of him. God moves on. Secondly, the mountain goat and the deer, combining both of these because they live in often hard to reach places. Not around here, deer everywhere. These are speaking of the deer in the mountains here. The deer up on the side of the cliffs and so on. First of all, verse 1 of chapter 39. Do you know the time the mountain goats give birth? Now, mountain goats in Job's region are likely to be, just like they are today in that area, the Nubian ibex. Nubian ibex. Sometimes ranchers are bringing this in over the years here, and they're putting them on big game ranches to hunt because they have these long, beautiful horns. But these are Nubian ibex, mountain goats, in the areas around Israel, Jordan, and the Middle East. You can see them on the cliffs of the Jordan Rift Valley, the Dead Sea, and the Wadi Araba. That Araba Wadi, sorry, which is a large, sometimes a stream when it rains, that divides Israel from Egypt. And in those regions, off on the cliffs, you will see these ibex walking along. Now, most mountain goats are only seen at a distance. We saw some bighorn sheep in Colorado. You see them from a distance. I've never gotten close to one. Maybe you can feed them with your hand. I've never tried it. Wouldn't want to try it. But you just see them existing from a distance. And God is saying, do you know when they're giving birth? Are you there? Have you seen one? Now you say, we got cameras today. But have you ever been there personally and seen it happen? I walked up once in Texas on the cliffs of the Colorado River, and I was hiking with friends as a teenager, and I came over a cliff and then down to a new level, and there was some afterbirth there from a Spanish mountain goat, we call them, just Spanish goats that have gone wild, and had given birth, and then walked off with its little one in just a matter of minutes. I didn't see it give birth, but I thought, how can a newborn animal walk on a strip on the side of a cliff so small and just follow after its mother? And I wasn't a believer then, but I thought, that's God. That's God who's made the animal to be able to do that right after it's born. Also ask here, God is asking Job, do you keep watch over the calving of the deer? How about when the fawns come out? We've got millions of deer in this area. Anybody ever seen one give birth? Like literally been there when it happens? And my wife was, we were talking about this on the way, and she was saying, well, that's because they give birth at night. We don't see them. And that's true, but I've seen many fawns, many who are barely walking, but I've never seen one born anywhere around here. And yet God has seen them. God causes it to happen. God times it. He does all of that. The second verse, can you count the months they fulfill? How long does it take for them to gestate? Even today, they have to just guess at this. They've, of course, put deer in captivity and watched them. And they still just give a rough estimate of about 200 days. But it varies. It varies per mama deer and so on. Or do you know the time they give birth? Job can't answer that. Verse 3, they kneel down. They bring forth their young. They do it. God sees it. They send out their labor pains. They go through that whole process. Job's done none of that. He hasn't designed the birth process. He hasn't caused these animals to get pregnant and give birth. He hasn't done any of that. But God keeps watch over them. The children become strong. Explain that. Explain how this little tiny thing just squirts out and then gets up a few minutes later and walks off. And then a few weeks later, it's running around on its own. And in verse 4, after it becomes strong, they grow up in the open field. They leave and do not return. It's not long before the animals roam off, start their own family somewhere else. This is amazing when you think about it. God has designed this and he sustains this, and it's still going all the time throughout our world. Dwayne Garrett remarks here, when it's time to give birth for humans, the wise woman or the midwife arrives to practice midwifery and help the mother through the difficult process. As much as possible, people seek to create supportive environments for this harsh experience. By contrast, mountain goats go through gestation in the wilderness. They're exposed to the elements and to predators. They give birth unattended on rocky hillsides and are utterly vulnerable. Their kids must quickly learn to scramble up mountainsides to survive the dangers all around them. And yet, with no benefits from wisdom or civilization, God enables them to thrive. How is that possible? There's no veterinarian there to oversee these things. How can they survive? That's just a modern mindset that we have. God keeps them alive. God sustains them, and they live on. Thirdly, the third group, the wild donkey. The wild donkey in verses 5-8. Who sent out the wild donkey free? So it wasn't always free. These are donkeys that have escaped captivity, and they have gone out and become wild. They've multiplied out in the wilderness. And who loosed the bonds of the swift donkey? These are fast. These are animals that just roam and run around. I've not seen wild donkey. There's about 15,000 of them, I understand, in the western United States. 12 to 15,000 wild donkeys. I've seen wild horses run out there. And that's amazing to look at. But even in our country, we have thousands and thousands of wild donkeys. They're also called burros, roaming the public lands. And God is asking Job, look, did you send them out there? Did you cause them to run out there and multiply like that and see all of those wild donkeys, Job? Just look at them. Did you do that? Did you cause their bonds to loosen? But God did that. God brought that about in his sovereignty. So verse 6, he continues with this line of questioning, for whom I have set the desert plain as a home. I've given these things a home. It's where nobody else lives. It's out in the wilderness. Well, there's not many people, not many buildings, not much food, and also the salt land as his dwelling place. Usually salt land is not where people can live. You can't grow crops where there's a lot of salt in the ground. And so while donkeys live out there, harsh environments, they're not living in the comfort of a barn like the donkey in town. They're not living with a bed of hay, with plenty of animal feed, and yet God takes care of them. The desert plain here is literally in Hebrew, the arba or araba. Sometimes we see it in our Bible. And so this is a word that means in Hebrew, a desert area. It comes to be called the desert area between the Dead Sea and the Sea of Aqaba. And so it's just a large thing if you look on your Bible maps called the Araba. So maybe he's talking about the wild donkeys that are all over that region at the time. Also, we get our modern word, or ancient word too, Arabia from this, and Arabs comes from this because they lived in a deserted place, a desert. And these donkeys are living out there in this salt area, probably around the Dead Sea or in Arabia. There's salt lands and there's hardly anything to eat. But they're wild, they're free, and God has made them like that. Verse 7, here's this donkey, Job. Can you tell this donkey what to do is the idea in verse 7. He laughs at the tumult of the city. There's a lot of noise in the city. People are shouting out. In fact, the shoutings of the driver, he does not hear, meaning the driver of a donkey pulling a cart. Here comes the cart. It's loaded with materials going through town. The driver is shouting at the donkey to do something because donkeys are stubborn. And these wild donkeys, they don't even care. They don't even hear that. They're roaming way outside of the city. Job, did you do that? Did you make it so these donkeys don't even come into town and they don't care about what people say? They don't obey anybody. The donkey doesn't listen to the shoutings of the driver like the tame donkey does. The donkeys of the wild have none of these constraints. God put them there. God takes care of them. I don't know if you've ever come across some wild donkeys. We did in Cripple Creek, Colorado. We were driving through that little mining town, and here comes this herd of donkeys in the street. And Autumn's yelling at them, trying to get them to move, and then she starts talking to them. And they just stare at you. They don't move. They just stare at you. And these were semi-domesticated. They fed them a little bit in town. And they're just sitting in the road, not moving. So we had to back up and go a different way. These things are stubborn. And yet God is saying, look, I made them that way. I made them the way they are. Did you do that, Job? This donkey also, in verse 8, he explores the mountains for his pasture and searches after evergreen thing. So he's in the desert places, in the salt lands. There's not much food, but there is enough. There's enough for them to live on and multiply. In fact, who put that green thing there? Who put that pasture there where they go to eat? Can Job find such food for the donkeys? No, only God can. Number 4, now we get to a powerful beast here. The wild ox, verses 9 to 12. This is a fourth category here, the wild ox. It should be a separate paragraph. It's probably not in most of your Bibles. This is a very powerful beast. Oxen, just by itself, we see ox or oxen. This is not a different species than cattle. Oxen is basically cattle that are over 4 years of age, and they've been trained to pull heavy loads. So when we think of America, American history, we think of horses pulling the plow. We might think of mules, but in the ancient world and in many parts of the world today, they use cattle, either bulls or cows that are over 4 years old to do the heavy work, and they will pull the plow for the farmers. But this is not one of those. This is a wild ox. This is not an ox that's gone wild like the donkey who's gone wild. This is a whole different species of animal. To understand what the animal is, I want to take you through a short history of the translation of this word. You may have seen these words when you've read the King James Bible. In Hebrew, the word is re'im, or re'em. And when the Septuagint, that's the Greek translation of the Old Testament, was translated, they were translating it in Egypt. They probably weren't quite sure what this animal was. It's not really known to have existed in the area in the deserts of Egypt, especially Alexandria, where they were translating this. And so somehow they got in their mind that the best Greek word for this is keros or monoceros, which means one-horned. Probably because the animal in Hebrew that they then saw on the two-dimensional drawings looked like it had one horn. In other words, if you take a bull from the side and you draw it, it looks like it has one horn until you change the shape or angle of it. And so they said, the monoceros. Then the Latin Vulgate comes along, and the Latin Vulgate doesn't know what to do with this Hebrew word. Jerome, the guy who translated the Latin Vulgate, says, hey, I'm going to look to the Septuagint. One-horned? We've got a Latin word for that. Rhinoceros, or rhinoceros, nose-horned. This thing's got a horn coming out of its nose. And so as people are trying to figure this out, they're going with one of two options, the one-horned animal or the rhinoceros, which is also called the rhinoceros in Africa. The King James comes along in Luther's German Bible. This is King James 1611, Luther's German Bible 1534, and they translate it one-horned animal or unicorn, one horn. So that's where you get unicorns in the King James Bible. Then suddenly modern history comes along. We're digging up sites. We dig up these other languages that are very close to Hebrew, sites that have Akkadian literature in there, Arabic literature, and Ugaritic. Akkadian and Ugaritic are no longer being spoken, but there were cities that spoke those. They wrote it and scratched it in tablets. We dig those up. And what do they have? Some of these words like re'im. And with that, they have this massive bull-like beast with one horn, but only because it's from the side and two-dimensional. And so what is a re'im? We call these today, which are now extinct. That's because the people who named it from Germany, when they discovered some of these skeletons and fossils, just gave it the name wild ox. In German is aurochs. It's now extinct, but it was around in Job's day. There were plenty of them. There's drawings of them everywhere in the ancient world. In fact, they lived in Europe till about the 16 to 1700s. So I'm giving you the context so you can understand the questions that God is asking Job. Let's talk about how big these things are. Compared to domesticated cattle today, a wild aurochs was taller, up to 6 feet. That's about right here for me. That was their shoulder height, 6 feet high. The much heavier than cattle, about 1,500 to 3,000 pounds. These things are big. That's bigger than the biggest bull you can think of. And some of these aurochs bulls were 6 feet across at the shoulder, and they were very aggressive. They weren't even compared to rodeo bulls who were very aggressive. These were extremely ferocious animals. You didn't mess with them. And if you were to think of a Brahma bull today, if you've ever been to a rodeo, the Brahma bull is the one with the big hump. That's the one they like to let the cowboys ride on, the bull riders. Big, aggressive bull, about twice that size in height and in width and everything in weight. This comes up a lot in the Bible. In the Old Testament speaks of this animal. It's just translated wild ox, but re'im in Hebrew comes up quite a bit. Go back to Deuteronomy 33. Deuteronomy 33. This is why we know it's not a unicorn or the mythical beast called the unicorn. Yeah, there's going to be some beasts that are extinct that come up in Job. We're going to talk about some of those in the coming weeks. But this is one of them, aurochs. Deuteronomy 33 mentions this because they're a symbol of strength. Nobody can tame them. Nobody can tell them what to do. These are ferocious beasts. They're not going to attack you and eat you, but they are going to do some great damage to you if they take a run at you. And so in Deuteronomy 33:17, as the firstborn of his ox, splendor is his, and his horns are the horns of the wild ox. This is speaking of Joseph here, the tribe of Joseph. His horns are like the horns of a wild ox. What does that mean? With them, with these great massive horns of this powerful beast, with him, he will push the peoples all at once, the ends of the earth. And those are the 10,000s of Ephraim, and those are the thousands of Manasseh. So Joseph's tribe is going to be very strong, but he compares it to the horns of the wild ox, the aurochs. And by the way, it's horns plural, right? Which means it's not one horn, it's two horns. That's why it's not a unicorn, but we'll take it up with the King James translators when we see them in heaven. So let's get into the text then. Verse 9 here. You understand the context, the historical context of this beast that's now extinct, that's huge, that's massive, that's powerful. Okay, Job, it's all questions in this section, by the way. It's the only paragraph where it's all questions. Will the wild ox consent to serve you? Or will he spend the night at your manger? Are you going to get this thing to come home with you, to stay in your barn, to eat from the manger, the feed trough? Is he going to give his consent to serve you? You'd have a better chance of training an elephant to come home with you and stay with you. This thing is not going to do it. No one could. In fact, the different kings of the ancient civilizations would go out and hunt these things, and then they would make these drawings of them to show how powerful they were. If you could go on a hunt and kill an aurochs and kill a bunch of them, then you must have been very strong and important in the ancient world. And God says, can you tame this thing? Can you bring it home? Make it your buddy? Make it your pet? Verse 10, can you bind the wild ox in a furrow with ropes, or will he harrow the valleys after you? Can you get this thing contained and use him to pull the plow? Can you get him to plow a straight line for you, Job? Think you can do that? Or you think that you can get him to harrow, to go along and dig up the ground after you? After you, meaning here it's a two-person job in the ancient world to plow. You've got a normal ox or oxen, two of them, and you've got the plow. Somebody is on the plow pushing it down into the ground, and somebody's in front with a rope leading the oxen in a straight line. So who wants to be in front of the ox if you could even tame him? Who wants to be in front of him leading him along as he's plowing for you? Are you going to do that, Job? No, you're not going to do that because that thing would charge you and take you out really fast. Job, verse 11, will you trust him because his power is great and leave your labor to him? Are you going to put him in charge of plowing your fields? He's going to make a mess of everything. Even if you could harness him, which isn't possible, he's going to destroy your plow. He's going to destroy your farm. He's going to be like truly a bull in a china closet. This is a ferocious beast. Verse 12, will you believe him? We trust him that he will return your seed of grain and gather it for your threshing floor. Are you going to take the cart out to the field when the grain's ready and put it in that cart? And are you going to trust the ox to get all of your precious grain back to the barn? No, the answer is no. What's he going to do? He's going to eat that grain and you're not going to be able to stop him. He may kill your farmhands if you try to stop him. You are not going to get your grain back into the barn. It's not happening because the ox is powerful. Job, I created this, God says. I made this animal and you can't do anything with it. That would be great to have that kind of power on your farm, right? That's like having a massive tractor in modern times. But it's not possible to tame that. There's no example ever in history that someone could tame an ox. Next, we go to the ostrich. Told you it was a zoology lesson tonight, but what's the point? The point is God has created these things. God sustains these things. And we don't do anything. We don't give God advice. God, I would like for you to bring the ox back into existence so we could see one. God's not listening to that. It's his world. It's his plan. His sovereignty. Number 5, the ostrich. Verse 13, the ostrich's wings flap joyously, but are they the pinion? Different translations will have different things here, but are they the pinion and plumage of a stork? So here comes this ostrich, and it makes a big show of its wings. It's a very happy animal. Very joyful, it seems like a kid just out having fun as it flaps its wings with great joy. But if you look at the wings and compare them to other birds, it's kind of ratty, right? It's kind of stringy. The ostrich wings are kind of stringy. They're not that beautiful compared to even a stork. A stork has these nice shapely wings when it raises them up. It's got the black tips on there and the white feathers. They're very shapely, very formally. The ostrich, it's quite a beast, but it's a foolish beast in many ways. Now, at the end of this, verse 13, the ESV and the NASB have a different translation. They have the plumage of love. So they combine some words in this verse to translate the plumage of love at the end of verse 13. But the word is better understood as a stork. It's interesting, though, to look at how they get love here, because it is a possible translation. The Hebrew word for stork, kaseda, kaseda. That's the word for a stork. But it's based on the word chesed or hesed, which I can't say the Hebrew chah, but it's chesed. And that's God's covenantal love, God's faithful love, God's loving kindness. And so translations will look at this and say, it's really talking about the plumage of love here on another bird. But no, this is actually the name for a stork. It comes up in other passages of Scripture. And it's thought that the name for the stork gets that in Hebrew because it was considered to be very kind and loving to its young. So like God is hesed to his people, this bird is very kind to its young. In fact, we even have myths in our culture where the stork is so loving that it brings the babies to the parents, right? And so the stork gets the name Hesida connected to something loving. Continuing with the ostrich, it's not like the stork. It's a big bird with lots of feathers, but it's not beautiful and loving like the stork. For she, the ostrich, leaves her eggs to the earth and warms them in the dust. So ostriches, they bury their eggs in the sand. Big eggs, hard shells, it's hard to crack them. But most animals protect their young. Most animals sit on the nest. When something comes, they will attack what comes. Not the ostrich, it runs away. Now, we haven't lived in areas where ostrich roam wild, but that's what happens. It runs away. It's trying to draw the predators away from the eggs, but humans just walk up. Ostrich runs off. They pick up the eggs. You go home. You make yourself a big omelet. Big omelet. So there you have the ostrich not having wisdom. Verse 15, she forgets that a foot may crush them or that a beast of the field may trample them. Now, scientists will tell you, look, the Bible's wrong here. They're trying to do this to protect their offspring. The shell is too hard. If you step on it, it won't crush. That's not the point, though. The point is that unlike the other animals, she runs away from her eggs, and you could go across them and crush them. Certainly a bigger beast would crush them. A wagon, a car today would crush them. And so the idea is she doesn't have a lot of sense if you're just comparing her to other birds even. She forgets them. Whereas the stork is beautiful, it cares for its young. The ostrich is a big, ugly, goofy-looking thing. And it does not have the same care for its young. Lamentations 4:3, even jackals offer the breast. They nurse their young. But the daughter of my people has become cruel like ostriches in the wilderness. They seem to be cruel from our vantage point by leaving their young and running off. God made this bird, though, Job. Can you understand that? Can you understand how God did that and how God made that? He continues on with this ostrich. She treats her children cruelly as if they were not hers. Though her labor be empty, she's without dread. She doesn't have a clue in the world, is the idea. She has no clue what's going on. These birds, they just do what they want to do and they run off because God has made her forget wisdom. God made that bird like that. Big bird, can't fly, but it's a bird. Weighs 300 pounds, got these long, lanky legs. What are you doing there, God? Well, he's doing something. He's glorifying himself with a variety of animals on the earth. And he's saying, Job, can you do that? Can you make that? God has made her forget wisdom and has not given her a share of understanding. Seems foolish to us as we consider the bird. And verse 18, however, this is the however, when she raises herself up high, she laughs at the horse and his rider. God says, imagine that. Here's this big, ugly bird, has no sense and leaves its eggs. But when it comes to a race, that thing will outrun a horse. That will outrun a horse. 300 pounds, roughly, is what an ostrich weighs. When they run, their strides are about 15 feet apart when they run. And they have been clocked somewhere in the mid-40s miles per hour. Okay, that's faster than the racehorses that run around the track. Those run at best about 30 miles per hour. These ostriches are getting close to 50 miles per hour. God made them, and he didn't give them much sense in one way, but yeah, they can outrun a horse and its rider. Now we move on to number 6, the horse itself. And not just any horse, not a racehorse, but a war horse. 19 to 25 speaks of God's wisdom and sovereignty in creating a horse that's willing and ready and eager to go into battle. Verse 19, do you give the horse his might? Do you clothe his neck with a mane? Do you make the horse strong, is what he's saying. Do you make it beautiful with the mane that flows down its neck? Did you do that, Job? Did you create this horse strong? You may have seen maybe the American quarter horse that cowboys will use, and sometimes people just have to ride. Big, huge muscles on these things. Massive. Did you do that? Did I do that? No, God did that. That's amazing. Do you make him leap like the locust? A horse can jump. His splendid snorting is terrible. If you come this way to the church, you'll go buy some horse properties down there. And don't do this if you're driving, but the rest of the people in the car can look through and see those properties. And they've got all kinds of horse things back there. They've got a track that they run around. They've got these jumping things that horses do and so on for competition. Did you make that, Job? Did you make this splendid horse? His snorting is terrible, verse 20. Do you make him leap like a locust or his snorting? That scares people right there sometimes, right? You get a kid up close to a horse and it does that, kid will jump. He paws in the valley and rejoices in his power where he goes out to meet the weapons. So there's a valley, that's where the battles would take place, especially if you had horses. You're not going to have horses in the mountains fighting or in the forest. But you would do this in the valley. Sometimes they would be pulling a chariot, the ancient tanks of warfare. Solomon had many horses. Before that, Israel didn't have a lot of horses, but Solomon had thousands of horses and chariots. He had a massive army. And here comes the battle, and the horse is ready to go. He's pawing the ground. The war horse wants to do it. Did you make that, Job? Did you create a horse that would be eager to go into battle? Other animals won't do that. Other horses that aren't war horses won't do that. Verse 22, not only is he eager, but he laughs at dread and is not dismayed. A horse will charge on while the person riding it may not be ready for battle. They may be scared. But here is this horse, and he's not afraid of anything. He laughs at dread. He is ready to get into battle. There in the Middle Ages, they would put a lot of armor on these horses. And they would be the shock troops that just went in, and they might defeat 10 people, 20 people to one horse and its rider. In ancient times, it would be like that as well. Maybe not quite as many, but they had spears, and they could run the horses very fast into the line of infantry. And they could take out not only people with the spear, but the horse would step on a lot of people and create havoc, create panic, and kill people just by stepping on them. The horse is ready. He does not turn back from the sword. He's not scared. He's not running away. God made the horse. God made it able to do that. The quiver rattles against him. Sometimes when troops would run up in battle and they would see archers getting ready to fire their arrows out, they're going to be hesitant. They're going to want to run or at least grab a shield real quick. Not the horse. He doesn't care. He is continuing to go. The spear comes up. The javelin gets thrown. There goes the horse without any fear. Did you make him, Job? With shaking and rage, verse 24, he races over the ground. He does not stand still at the sound of the trumpet, of the shofar. They didn't have a brass trumpet. They had these horns that they hollowed out and blew for battle sounds. Did you do that, Job? Did you make a horse that will obey the sound of a horn blowing? And even if the horn says it's time to retreat, that horse is still going. He is ready to fight. Who could make such a creature? Yeah, we can train them. We can do certain things and get people with some wisdom to train them. But God made the animal able to even do that. You ever thought about that? Who can make a dog obey? We can train a dog to obey, but God put that wisdom in the dog to obey. Now, cats, yeah, I'm not going to get into that, but verse 25, as often as the trumpet sounds, look, this horse is ready. Aha! It's not a laughing sound. This is, I'm ready. Yeah, let's go. The horse is ready for battle when the trumpet sounds. He sensed the battle from afar. He smells that battle is coming. He's ready to go, and the thunder of the commanders and the shout of war. He is ready. He's eager. Just like an animal would be ready to eat. This horse goes into battle. This was a fearsome beast. Not quite the wild animal like the rest of these on the list. But I'm telling you, if you're in battle, especially if you're walking or running at the other side, and here comes a line of cavalry, you're going to be shaking in your boots because these things are wild in the sense that they're awesome, powerful, magnificent. God made that. Lastly here, the hawk and the eagle. The hawk and the eagle. Number 7, the hawk and the eagle grouped together, similar animals, birds of prey. And so God's going to group them together here. Verse 26, is it by your understanding that the hawk soars, stretching his wings toward the south? Probably because the hawks in that region, maybe hairier hawks, that go to the south to mate in the mating season and then migrate back up north. Either way, though, they could just be getting up there to take the south winds and fly high. The point is right here that, did you do that, Job? That's magnificent. You think of a hawk up there in the sky. How does it stay up there so long? It's wind currents, and we know, yeah, but who made it to do that? It doesn't really even flap its wings. If you watch a hawk, it gets up there on those air currents, and it just stays up there, or it'll circle around and hardly move its wings. It's amazing. We love to hear. We have a bunch of red-tailed hawks in our neighborhood. We're always hearing them, seeing them. And the other day, they were circling our backyard because we have some birds on the ground out there that they want to eat. And you could just hear them talking to one another, making this shrieking noise. Magnificent beasts. Did you do that, Job, by your understanding? Did you make the hawk and make him soar so high? Did you stretch out his wings, that massive wingspan that they have? Verse 27, is it at your command that the eagle goes on high and raises his nests on high? Did you make that? We saw an eagle's nest in Colorado. It had been there, they say, at Glen Eyrie Castle. It had been there over 100 years, the same nest. And they just keep coming back, the family of eagles. Huge, massive nest on the top of this cliff. Just amazing. And the fact that they know, no matter where they go, they always come back there to lay their eggs. That's amazing too. God designed them like that. God made them like that. And they raise up on high as well to search out prey, to look for this tiny little mouse in a field out here. And they can see it from that high up. And then they swoop down and will catch it. We don't have bald eagles or the kind of eagles probably that Job had in his area, but we do have Mexican eagles or carcaras. And you'll see them sometimes out with vultures. But we have those in our neighborhood, and we can hear them, we can see them, and they're magnificent just to look at, beautiful creatures. And they have these wings, and they soar, and that's all for the glory of God. On the cliff he dwells, that's where he makes his lodging, his nest. On the rocky crag, a fortress. He makes it up there high where nobody can get to the eagle's nest. No predators can get to the eagle's nest. From there he spies out food. He looks at the food from up on high. God gave him such eyesight. Don't we wish we had eyesight as we're getting older like that? Eagle eyes. His eyes see it from afar. His young ones also suck up blood. How do these young eagles, these tiny little bird things, hatch out of an egg and become this massive creature that can hunt prey? They have a record of them, an eagle, swooping down, trying to grab a toddler one time. They say it happened, they wrote it up in the early 1900s, that a two-year-old was even attempted to be taken up by an eagle that swooped down. These things are massive and strong. And the young ones, the young little eagles, get the food brought back to them by their parents. They get to be provided for. God provides for them as well. And wherever things are slain, that's where you're going to see the birds circling, either because they slew it or they're going to get some fresh meat before the vultures come in. All of these animals, all 10 of them that we looked at, God has made. We can barely even understand today how these things work. And if we can't understand them, we don't see them often in nature. If we were just to go about our normal lives, we wouldn't see these animals have their young, birth their young. We wouldn't see the eagle's nest unless you want to climb up the cliff and try to take on one of these eagles. But yet God has designed them. God in his wisdom has made them. Job can't explain any of that. Did you catch any of his answers here? I didn't see any answers. He's going to answer in chapter 40, but his answer won't be to any of these questions. He's going to speak to God, but he can't answer how or why these things do what they do. Mankind does not have the wisdom of God. We've got to get a proper biblical view of mankind. Sometimes we say, amen, lower ourselves, worship God. And then we turn right around during the week and say, look how awesome humanity is. We got bombs and we got military and we got AI and we got all this. They couldn't even find a giraffe in the hill country for 2 weeks. 2 weeks, a giraffe is running around in the hill country. And they had helicopters out, they had people out. They couldn't even find it. We're not the be-all, end-all. God is. God made everything. God is all wise. God is all powerful. We struggle just to get up and do the things we need to do each day. Mankind is not going to somehow make ourselves live forever and somehow take the sovereignty from God over all things. It's not possible. Suffering is going to come into our lives. We're not going to be able to extend death off way out into the future and live hundreds and hundreds of years. We're not going to make all suffering go away from our life. Suffering is going to come. When we try to not make it come, it will come another way, maybe. It will come. May not be related to our sin, like Job. God's sovereign over it, though. Be assured of that. If you're one of his and suffering comes upon your life, God is sovereign over it. If he takes care of the lions and the ravens, if he takes care of the aurochs until he let it go out of existence, don't you think he'll take care of us until it's our time to go out of existence and be with him? Or until Christ comes back? Don't you think God will take care of us in our suffering, no matter what we're going through, no matter how much it hurts, no matter how long we think we can't bear it? You don't hear the animals complaining. God made them. He takes care of them. Jesus said that he takes care of the flowers of the field. Look how he dresses them. Don't worry, little flock. He takes care of the grass that's here one day and gone the next. He brings beautiful flowers out of the ground that will disappear soon. Certainly, he will take care of us. He takes care of the animals. Job can't answer these questions. Job doesn't have understanding, and we don't either. So we need to give God the glory. We need to thank him for taking care of us, even amidst suffering, and just say over and over that he is sovereign and not try to take that sovereignty somehow from him. Lord, we trust you. We thank you. We know you're sovereign over our lives and have done everything in our lives to get us to this very second. You will continue to sustain us until it's our time to be with you. We thank you, Lord, for that. Thank you for providing for us. You take care of the smallest insect, animal, these animals that eat dead flesh, you take care of them. Certainly you will take care of not just mankind, but your people, the ones you're in covenant with, Lord. Thank you that we can trust in you, that you are not just sovereign, but you're good. You're a good God who exercises his sovereignty in a good way. Even though we don't understand it, we love you, and we want to continue to grow in our faith. Help us of little faith as we learn to trust in you more. In the name of Jesus, amen.